This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. And we are delighted to have a special guest that is Eric Nettle. Eric is partner and senior portfolio manager at Nine Point Partners Limited from Toronto. He's dialed in. Welcome, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Eric is one of those rare breeds. He's a portfolio manager that specializes in oil and gas energy investments. And so we want to talk to Eric at length because, you know, one of the top issues in our industry is investment. Now, there's a lot of talk about investment, and that word can take on many meanings when we think about the oil and gas industry. One meaning is investment by companies back into the ground to drill more wells, to develop oil fields, and that puts a lot of people to work. And that definitely has been compromised. But also compromised over the course of the summer especially is the investment into the shares of publicly traded oil and gas companies, in other words, the equities. And we've seen a real movement downward, unfortunately, a real weakness in publicly traded oil and gas companies, all the way down from the biggest players in the space to certainly the very smallest. So we really want to understand that, talk about that. And Eric's been very vocal on Twitter and BNN and other mediums. And so it's great to have him here. But before we get to Eric, I know, Jackie, that you have published recently a chart that actually shows the downward movement of the basket of oil and gas stocks on the Toronto Stock Exchange.
Yes, so we posted the chart in August, and we will put a link to this in the show notes, but it shows sort of two disconnects when we consider the time period between the beginning of 2017 and now. So over 2017, especially the end of 2017, we started to see Canadian and U.S. oil and gas equities diverge. So we started to suffer from lower prices in Canada due to a lack of takeaway capacity. And so by the end of 2018, Canadian upstream oil and gas companies were down 40%. This is a basket of companies that, right, you know, that is upstream only, not integrated, or companies that have refining.
Right. So if you own shares in a handful of oil sands companies and non-oil sands companies, say gas producers, on average, you'd have seen your portfolio of investments drop by 40%.
That's right. From the beginning of 2017 to the end of 2018. Meanwhile, U.S. upstream producers were down as well over that period, but yep, they were down about half as much, so down 20%. Yep. And so this is what we're calling the Canadian disconnect. Due to our takeaway issues and some of these Canadian-specific issues, we saw a larger drop on average for oil and gas public stocks.
So you mean by takeaway, like pipeline issues, basically?
Yeah, like just, you know, seeing bigger price discounts because we have distressed barrels that can't get out in the market.
Right.
Now, at the start of 2019, something else happened. We started to see oil and gas stocks start to decouple from oil price. Up until then, you know, if oil price went up, we would see those stocks go up. And that should happen because as oil price goes up, these companies generally generate more cash flow and they're stock should be worth more.
So the tide of oil prices going up globally would also lift the share prices of the companies somewhat uniformly historically.
Historically it has.
But that's not happening anymore. The price of oil, you know, went actually for a while there again. It was in the high 40s and then moved up to 60. But actually the share prices of Canadian oil and gas companies went down, not up.
Yeah, I mean, the oil and gas stocks have totally decoupled this year from oil price. Mm-hmm. Oil price up about 20% over the year. But Canadian oil and gas producers, that group I talked about before, that index, down about 16%. Americans are down 5% over that period. But it's worth noting over the summer, the Americans have really fallen as well. And in fact, yeah, they've fallen more than Canadians just over the period of the summer. So now we've got a situation where it doesn't seem to matter what oil price is. Investors just aren't that interested. And lots of interesting things that have happened because of that, which I'm sure we'll talk about with Eric, but, you know, very high dividends now as a result of that. Companies being delisted from major indexes because their equity values are getting so small that they're not relevant to the index. And so we want to talk about all these issues and the implications.
Well, let's talk about them right now. So Eric, why don't you bring you into the conversation? I mean, from your perspective, sitting in Bay Street, what is going on with investor sentiment as it relates to oil and gas stocks?
Well, I think we all recognize the energy market is broken. And it's broken for reasons that Jackie went through. We have decoupling, the largest in history between the commodity and the producers. And to boil it down, I think we've just simply run out of buyers for equities. The weakness that we see in the markets, I don't think, are from significant selling pressure. All the forced liquidation and fund managers being tapped on the shoulder to de-risk, that occurred really last year. I think what we're seeing is the market has underperformed for too long. Performance has been too poor relative to other sectors. So with energy falling and other subsectors making all-time highs, I just think people have lost patience. And so even though we see stocks now trading at their lowest levels in history, in certain niches like the small cap space, there's no buyers, there's no liquidity. I tried to buy 500,000 shares of a mid-cap Southeast Saskatchewan producer today, and it took me the better part of half a trading day to buy what before would have taken me 30 minutes.
So, well,
for the benefit of our audience, let's talk about that liquidity. So first of all, there's a broad spectrum of size of company in Western Canada, all the way from publicly traded companies that at the low end, would you say like 5 or 10,000 barrels a day, all the way up to the big players in the oil sands that are 200-300 up to 500,000 barrels a day, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And so when you say that it takes you a long time to buy the shares, it's just that there's just no activity. Like in a market, it's sort of like going to a farmer's market and there just isn't enough fruit and vegetables on the stands.
Yeah, and what we're seeing now, and Jackie mentioned, there's several companies being deleted from the TSX because their market caps have fallen too low. We're seeing in Canada just more and more concentration in the large caps. So if you look at, there's only two producers now and three pipeline companies, and those five stocks take up 75% of the energy index. And so as capital has been flowing out of the sector, if you're a large $10 billion generalist fund manager in Canada, all you really have to do is spend time on two individual stocks, the two largest integrated companies in Canada, and you haven't really been penalized by not going down what the perceived quality food chain. Mm-hmm. So there's just a complete vacuum of interest, especially when retail investors are challenged to convince themselves to yet again commit capital to stocks that are falling. Retail advisors just simply have no patience to have to justify owning energy anymore. It's I think for most Canadians, it's probably 5 to 20% of their portfolio and probably 50% of meeting time for trying to explain why the stocks have been doing so poorly. In energy funds, I really consider myself and only one other company as being active in the market on a daily basis. So there's just been a massive shrinking in available capital for Canadian energy names.
And I talked about the indexes, but overall, since the beginning of 2017, on average, these Canadian upstream equities are down about 50%. But there are certain names that are down much, much more, like in the range of 70 or 80%. And you're talking about the fact there's not very many people in the market anymore. And I think you explained the reasoning that people have just lost patience putting their money in other places. But is there other factors as well? Like how important is this being delisted from these major indexes for those companies that are facing that because their equity values are so low? Like I imagine by being in that index, you pick up a lot of investors by default that now you're not going to get.
You absolutely do. And so we know the trend in investment management over the past several years has been more funds flow into passive, less into active, more money into quant-based funds as opposed to active. And the most recent stat I saw for the U.S., and I think Canada were a little behind the curve, but it's not too far off, and that is that 60% of assets under management now are in passive funds, 20% are in algo and quant funds. So that leaves only 20% in what's determined to be active. But we know that many funds are closet indexers, like at minimum half. And so if you strip that out, you're left with only 10% of total assets that are active. And mm-hmm. So that means that if you're not in a well-followed index, and many of our small caps are going to be deleted in a couple of weeks. We've seen Montney producers fall 10-15% in a day on relatively benign quarters. Well, why is that? It's because there's nobody left to step in on the long side, and there are hedge funds without a doubt that short the stocks knowing that there's that vacuum of buying. So you can push the stock down very easily, 10-20% in this market.
Well, yeah, I want to come back to the quantitative and the algorithmic trading in a little bit. I want to come to that because those are big changes in the financial services industry. And, I want to come back to this notion that Jackie brought up of, quote, the investors that are, or were active have lost patience. So let's dive into that a little bit deeper. Lost patience with what? Not making any money, lost patience with ESG issues, or like, well, what is it that they've lost patience with?
I think it's a long list. Certainly in Canada, we had some Made in Canada issues. We all know the plight of lack of egress out of Canada and customer concentration. Differential applying at $50 last year was really devastating to sentiment. When we have certain federal leaders express that they think that it's, you know, Alberta's had its turn and now it's the time for others and such. So that's really eroded interest in Canada. That's obvious. Energy in general, as though, I think, faces a significant image problem, because ESG investing is becoming more and more and more in vogue. So we've had like 3 conferences in Toronto just in the last 6 to 8 months when you'd never even heard the term before. And so I do think we all have to recognize that not only are there issues specific to Canada that hopefully will be fixed in the near future, but as energy investors, there's just simply not as much available capital today as there has been in the past. And so when we look at valuations today, on my metrics at least, they're trading at their lowest levels in history when you measure on a trading on a cash flow basis. Why use enterprise value to cash flow? Well, you know, 5 years ago, companies used to trade at 8 to 9 times. Today, they trade between 2.5 to 4 times on a reserve basis.
Yeah, potentially the most dominant issue is the fact that historically, the oil and gas industry has not really been very good at making money.
That is a reality. And thankfully, and this would have started, I would say, in the fall of 2017, the shift in mindset by many U.S. shale companies, where we had the growth for growth's sake and that whole phenomenon of capital destruction just to achieve production growth. And that is firmly not fashionable anymore. We see every single U.S. producer now commit to underspending the cash flow. There's a new focus on return of capital. You see the prioritization of dividends and buybacks, which is something that I and some others have been trying to transplant from the United States into Canada. So I think that's a very appropriate criticism of the past, Peter, but I think looking forward, people are not appreciating that despite having lack of pipeline capacity, due to cost rationalization, due to compression and product differentials, the profitability of many oil companies today is better than when oil was at $70 and $80 and $90. And that's just something that is being completely looked over when we look at valuations today. Like we have many holdings. Like the trading at $55 oil, they'd be at 15% free cash flow yields. At $60, they're trading at 20 to 25% free cash flow yield. So the fact that we can even speak about free cash flow shows you the significant shift these companies have undertaken.
Well, and it is very significant. And what we're seeing now, instead of taking all that cash flow and putting it back into the drill bit to grow their production, investors are saying, give me the dividends. I want the money back. Don't grow. Do you think all companies, in order to get back on track to increase their valuations, need to give a dividend?
I'm a big, big proponent of the industry in large, with the odd exception, effectively going to a zero growth mode, certainly now and most definitely for 2020, and committing every single dollar of free cash flow they have towards share buybacks, because I think that would achieve 2 things. One, earlier I mentioned the weakness in the equity markets today, the decoupling between oil and oil stocks, is not as a result of selling pressure. It's just we've run out of buyers. People's patience level is gone. It's shot. And so by committing 10%, 15% of free cash flow relative to market caps, that would, one, introduce buying into a market that is sorely lacking. And secondly, I think it would collectively shake investors from their coma by demonstrating how strong business models are today. I truly believe, like I'll get questions, I'm on BNN regularly in session, I get questions about, will company XYZ make it? Because, you know, we're only at $55 oil. And yet I'm talking about how they're trading at a 20% free cash flow yield. So there's just a complete disconnect. And so should companies be committing capital and free cash flow to buybacks? They absolutely should. And when we look at the bust today in valuations, when companies are trading below what I call their liquidation value, or their proved developed producing reserve value, that just means, you know, you could fire all of the management team, fire everybody, blow down the cash flow, discounted at 10%, and the total market cap in debt is below that value. So the market's ascribing no value for growth, no value for proved reserves, no value for 2P, no value for even infrastructure.
Yeah. When you have companies that are trading at like 2x their annual cash flow, it's sort of like you could own those companies and in 2 years get all your money back and everything else would be upside, right?
Privatized. And so when companies are trading at such distressed levels and have the free cash flow and have strong enough balance sheets, so like sub-2x debt to cash flow, and if at that point they are still not willing to buy back their own shares, then why should I? And why should anybody else?
So I have a question around the dividends. Back to that, you say that they need to give dividends and that will bring investors back. But the reality is, it's shocking how high the dividends are for some of these upstream oil and gas companies in Western Canada, because they've maintained their dividend payments even though their equity values have dropped a lot. So you have companies giving like double-digit yields in terms of their dividends. Now, it's not share buybacks. Like, why aren't those stocks being recognized? Their valuations aren't necessarily that much better than those that don't do that.
Right. I think there is, again, another misunderstanding that whenever you see dividend yields in excess of, let's say, 8%, typically and historically, that would have indicated that there's a bust in the business model. Companies are leaning on debt to pay the distribution stream. But today, because the equity value has fallen so far, the dividend yields by default then have gone up. And I can give specific examples. You know, you've got mid-cap oil producers yielding 8%. And when you look at dividend sustainability, at $55 oil, they could pay that 8 or 9% dividend yield and still next year be able to buy back about 10% of their shares outstanding. So for some companies, without getting specific, I think it's ego. You know, they've never cut, therefore they don't want to. It's a badge of honor for them. There's a certain element of their investor base that is counting on that. But I don't know if increasing dividends is going to be the fix, because there's this misperception of the cash flow generation capabilities of companies today. I think buybacks are going to be the help, at least bridge the gap between oil rallying nearly 25% this year and many oil stocks falling by 30 to 40%.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's actually somewhat simple. And I want to come back to this notion of free cash flow. And again, for the benefit of our audience, you know, that's the money that you make after you have covered all your expenses and you have also covered all your maintenance costs to keep your production level, right? And so, yeah, you know, that, as you earlier said, Eric, is a relatively new concept in the business, because all the money has historically gone back into just growing production. And I think, to be honest with you, the market really wants, overwhelmingly, is just a sustained quarter over quarter, you know, show me the money. Show me you can do it on a sustained basis. And we really haven't had enough time go by from the point that this investor edict went out, you know, show me the money, show me you can generate cash flow, show me you can buy my shares back, show me you can give me dividends, all that kind of stuff. I mean, honestly, it's only been like 18 months. And within that 18 months here in Canada, we had the punctuated event last November, December with the differential blowout and that whole drama. And so I think that, you know, we need to see from these companies, and it's happening, a sustained period of paying out these high dividend yields, buying the shares back. And I think that'll help to facilitate the market. Would you debate that?
No, I completely agree. I think, you know, the volatility in the oil price over the past 18 months, to your point, has not been assistive in allowing companies to have confidence that, okay, well, the oil price is going to be, you know, 55 or higher. Because as we know, at $50, industry generally just generates enough cash flow to keep the lights on.
Right.
At 55, you're generating about enough cash in excess of maintenance capital. About it, you could pay a 10% dividend, grow 10%, or buy back 10% of your shares. And at $60, by my math, that number roughly doubles. So you could grow 20%, pay a 20% dividend. This is the big gap space I'm talking about.
Well, and it's getting better with technology, right? I mean, the ability to lower your costs and generate even more, especially in the oil sands. I mean, we had Steve Lott and others on the show, and they attest to that.
And a key benefit we have in Canada is that corporate decline rates are materially lower than in the United States. It's why, as U.S. investors have demanded this fiscal responsibility underspend their cash flow, and yet there were some mid-cap Permian names that had, you know, 55% corporate decline rates. And so when you moderate your spending to the degree of 2x-1x cash flow or less, it's kind of the emperor has no clothes at that point. All of the falsehoods that U.S. shale companies have been telling their investors about, you know, multi-decades of inventory with no geological risk, with supply costs, you know, $30 and $40 per barrel, all of those falsehoods become revealed. And that's another catalyst why, and especially why I've repatriated a lot of my money from the United States back to Canada the past year or so, is that valuations in Canada are so compelling. And once people realize that this is not a sunset industry, that energy demand will continue to grow, and with it, oil demand for the next, I'm going to say, 20 years or so, despite how aggressive you want to be on electric cars and such, that what will people want? You want long tenure assets. You want low declines, meaning low maintenance capex, to juice your free cash flow. And so when you look at some large cap Canadian oil sands, and let's use $60 as an example, they're trading at 17, 18% free cash flow yields with 60 years of reserve life. And so I think that is where capital is going to come. We've not been aided by certain developments over the past couple of years on the pipeline side, but I'm optimistic that at least with increasing throughput, with drag reducers and compression, with crude by rail ramping to 600,000 barrels a day of capacity, even if you use the worst case scenario, which is rail economics, that you can still be very, very constructive on the valuation of Canadian energy names.
So, Eric, I want to come back to, you talked about this belief that maybe oil and gas is a sunset industry. And, you know, how big of a role do you think that's playing for the devaluation changes that we've seen? Because, you know, if that is truly the belief of investors, that may keep capital away, even if these companies do prove all the things that you're talking about, that they can generate cash and returns at these lower prices.
Yeah, I'd say that conversation really peaked about 2 years ago. Every investor meeting I had to have a slide or two on Tesla showing what percentage of total oil demand is for light passenger vehicles, and you make certain assumptions and you can still see demand growing. I think that those concerns have faded, but it's been replaced by a renewed focus on ESG investing, so the environmental, social, governance. But in Canada, it's like capital font size 30 of the E, and then nobody even pays attention to the S and the G. And we can debate whether that's been foreign-funded environmental groups or whatever, if it had been successful at achieving that result. But in the U.S., you know, the E's, the capital font letter 6, and it's really the G that takes part in the conversation. So I think that continued capital flight out of energy, it's not fashionable. You know, in the U.S. as well, energy is now about 4.5% of the S&P 500. So for a generalist fund manager, you can spend as much time on Apple and Starbucks as you can on all of the energy names. And we all know how complicated the energy sector has become, from having to worry about differentials and having to worry about spreads. And it's just become so complicated for the average guy to commit enough mental capital that they've just said, okay, well, you know, it's not worth it, and they've gone elsewhere.
Yeah, so speaking about, you know, Tesla, electric vehicles, and sunset industries and so on, substitution, disruptive change, I tell people in the oil and gas business, you know, okay, there's a lot of disruption, a lot of potential disruption, but in the financial services industry, your business, Eric, on Bay Street and so on, there's been massive disruptive changes in terms of substitution by black box algorithms replacing humans to do the trading. And we talked about that earlier in the show. To what extent, you know, is that a big factor, the fact that it's just a black box trading shares, and if it blacklists oil and gas, you can't talk to a black box to convince them otherwise?
It is definitely a concern. I'd be lying to say otherwise. I see it on a daily basis. Liquidity is dried up. The amount of guys that I have to trade with, like I've got buddies who run, you know, energy hedge funds and such, and a block will go up, and let's say I've sold or bought whatever stock XYZ, and they'll send a message to me on Bloomberg Messenger saying, hey, was that you? And it happened to be I was the buyer's seller, and they were on the other side. Like the market has shrunk so dramatically that it's one thing to say, well, we've got a lot of small cap and mid cap stocks in Canada that are incredibly undervalued, trading at 70% liquidation value and such. But unless there is a new injection of capital of active managers, not quant funds, because they obviously deal on with different metrics, names can chronically be cheap. And that's why so much of my energy and time now is going into conversations with CEOs on a very friendly basis, but just trying to make them appreciate how much the financial side of the market has changed, and why it's critically important that they use all of their free cash flow for share buybacks.
But do you think that this sort of black box algorithmic trading, okay, so it, you know, my sense, and I think you just sort of validated it, that it's shunning energy, shunning the oil and gas industry because it's coded into its algorithms at the moment. But isn't there a scenario under which it's the black box starts to recognize that there is money to be made in the business and that even the quantitative algorithmic trading starts coming back to the market to create liquidity?
I'm optimistic that there is such a scenario. I'm waiting for it. I think a lot of it's based upon positive earnings revisions. And with the volatility in crude, we haven't quite had it. But to your point, we could see a scenario where, you know, if it's 20-ish percent of AUM is quant and algo funds, and which have typically been very, very short the energy sector, it is a pool of at least short-term buying that we could see, and it happened in very dramatic fashion. I remember back in 2016, in January, when stocks were falling, free fall. And when you hit that turn in sentiment, things can rally really aggressively. We had one holding, and it was a mid-cap U.S. Bakken producer. The stock rallied 20% a day or more 3 days in a row. Hmm. And so I think computer programs are a lot less sensitive than human emotion is for bidding stocks up, even though they're going up. You know, the trend is your friend, so to speak.
Well, I think, are there things that companies can do to set themselves up to be picked by these algorithms? Like you talked about the fact, buying back a lot of your shares, having free cash flow, reporting on ESG metrics. Like, are there things that these algorithms are looking for that companies can position themselves to check those boxes?
I don't have a good enough answer for you on that. I've tried to investigate what variables go into the programs, but I've yet to get a really good conclusive answer to that question. But it's a very, very good question to ask.
I think it's a really good question, and I think it's actually an interesting question for the Securities Commission. Do those black boxes have an obligation to be more transparent about how they trade these stocks? Because we know that you, Eric, as a portfolio manager, have all sorts of regulatory rules that you have to follow and transparency and so on. So I think that this is an interesting area that has to be explored further, because I think that, you know, if we understand what the algorithms want and the companies deliver things like improved ESG performance and other variables, then therefore we should be able to get a better understanding of how the market works. I mean, market transparency is a fundamental tenet of capital markets.
I've done my best to find more information on like what the actual inputs are, and it's really closed off.
Okay, well, it's been a great discussion. I think to wrap it up, we should talk about what do you think, like your bullet list of what needs to change? I think we've hit on a lot of these, but you know, altogether, what are the big things that you think need to change before we start to see a lot of interest flow back into the energy sector in general and then specifically into Canada?
I think specifically in Canada, there's two things. One, we've touched on it. Companies need to use every single dollar of their free cash flow this year, next, to buy back their shares. We have to admit that the energy sector is broken. The dislocation between the oil price and oil stocks is the widest in history, and we really do have to do some soul searching to figure out why that is. And secondly, I think industry has to fight back and tell its story and talk about the environmental progress that we've had, where Canada produces the third most ethical, social, and governance score barrel in the world, where the average barrel produced from a modern-day OSM project today equals the average barrel refined in the United States. How Canada sources oil from countries that still crucify and stone people to death, and how we could satisfy that demand internally. So I think industry, as we fight the disinformation campaign that's been waged on us for far too long, and we've been far too quiet, that will shape the narrative and allow, I think, more of those ESG dollars to come back to Canada, which have fled. From a larger macro perspective, I think the worries about the slowdown of the global economy have to dissipate a little, you know, whether that's aided by a truce between China and the U.S. heading into the U.S. elections, that would certainly help. And another factor I think that we're seeing in real time is the rate of growth of U.S. shale slowing to below the growth in oil demand. And we're seeing from companies getting greater responsibility and being responsive to what their shareholders are asking for, underspending the cash flow, prioritizing return of capital, drilling less, having parent-child issues and such. that you're now seeing the rate of growth in the U.S. fall from a run rate of about 1.8 million barrels a day. I think it will exit below a million barrels per day. And so that means, well, what happens then? There's a call on OPEC, and there's actually, you know, the narrative around multi-decades of U.S. shale with very low supply costs starts to dissipate, and that changes people's perception of both the medium and long-term price of oil. So there's a long list, but in our control now is really, again, it comes down to Canadian companies need to help shape the narrative. You guys do great work on that. And secondly, companies need to use their free cash flow for buybacks to demonstrate just how strong the business models are today.
Yeah, I mean, it's really getting back to summarizing a lot of what we said. It's, okay, number one, show me the money. Show you can deliver the money on a sustained basis. Show me you can deliver a cleaner barrel of oil, cubic foot of gas, and I'll come back and revisit the marketplace.
Well, when you look at companies trading at 20% free cash flow yields or higher, like, that situation will not last.
Mm-hmm.
You'll either see companies privatizing, companies being bought. I'm not a proponent of mergers of equals, but you could see an M&A wave, because it's just the attractiveness of valuations today is too compelling.
I mean, we've talked many times on this program about how arbitrages, you know, valuation differences, either in price of commodity or other variables, don't last. They just you can't have one market selling at bargain basement prices and another market selling at higher prices without eventually people waking up and going to the lower valued market.
Yeah, there's natural mechanisms in the marketplace to close those arbitrages. It blows my mind that companies today can be trading at like 70% of their effective liquidation value, where if you've got a deep enough or large enough pocketbook, you can effectively buy a company today and get billions of dollars for free solely because, not from fundamentals, but just because sentiment towards the sector is so poor for the moment.
Well, you know, we've run out of time. There's so much more we could talk about, but thanks, Eric, for your great insights and your ongoing optimism about the future of Canadian oil and gas. Would you like to tell our listeners your contact information if they want to talk to you off mic?
Yeah, you can easily catch me at ninepoint.com, and then I'm active on Twitter too. It's kind of a form of self-therapy.
Yeah.
So that's Eric Nuttall, and it's ninepoint, ninepoint.
That's right.
Yeah, and I follow Eric, and I totally recommend it. It's pretty entertaining.
No, thank you.
Great to have you, Eric. Thanks very much, and thanks to all for being on our program this week. And until next time.
Thank you for joining our podcast. If you like this show, please rate it on the app that you use and tell someone else about us.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.